Well, thank you. Thank you very much for that generous introduction, and thank you all for coming this evening. The subject of remembering the Great War is simply too big for any one individual to do justice to it. And over the next 4 or 5 years, that simple truth that the size and the scope of the subject defies individual consideration leads me to a view that this is really a matter of collective history. And I hope you take my remarks today as part of a conversation about how we link the moment when mass violence, legitimated by nation states and empires, crossed and inextricably became bound together with family history, how that simple fact of mass violence and family history affects perhaps all of us in this room. I know my family history was inflected in ways no one could have imagined, and I'm sure there are others in this room in the same position. Now, we are in a commemorative season, and I've been on a French presidential commission on how to commemorate the Great War 100 years on, in which every conceivable possibility, I think, has been aired. And yet, in some ways, every single one of them that I've heard about, this ubiquity of commemorative gestures planned over the next 5 years, every one of them hides a predicament, a question that dates from the 1914-18 conflict. The question is this: is it possible to honor the men who died in war without glorifying war itself? Seems a simple question, but one with a very difficult answer. I believe that it is possible, indeed, I believe it is essential to honor the between 9 and 10 million men who died by presenting a narrative of the Great War which spares no effort in showing the horrors of 50 months of industrial slaughter. The war was the first cinematic war, and soldiers themselves produced literally millions of photographs, not for the purpose of publication in the press or for propaganda, but for their own albums, which exist in attics and in family homes all over the world. Using the visual documents the war left in its wake, we can see and feel the meaning of the claim of the distinguished diplomat and historian George Kennan that the Great War was the ur-catastrophe of the 20th century, the disaster which set in motion, if not all, then most of the violent events of our times. I will go one step further. Seeing war, in my view, has consequences. Commemorating war has consequences. In my view, war remembrance, now in the season of the centenary of the outbreak of the Great War, is and must be a kind of pacifist project. The challenge we face, then, is to honor those who die in war without honoring war itself. And I want to suggest a number of ways out of this dilemma. These do not exhaust the possibilities, but open up the discussion. The first way is to recognize the yawning gap between the ordinary decencies of the men who went to war, like Edward Thomas, and the blindness, the stubborn persistence in old and impossible ideas of the men who led them into a kind of battle they had never seen before, a kind of battle they could not control. Their errors, their blindness, their arrogance in some case, their criminal incompetence in others, sentenced millions of men to torment, mutilation, and death. Industrialized war simply cannot be controlled. It can be endured. 50 years after I started to study the Great War, I still feel a shiver of cognitive dissonance when I speak about it. How can we understand so much suffering for so little gain? The poignancy of much war remembrance, of commemoration of the Great War 100 years after, derives from the simple reflection that nothing justified the horrors of that war. And remembering the Great War must move us for this reason alone. Now, one instance of this widely shared response to the tragedy of the 1914-18 war is a song written by the American poet Laurie Barth and set to the music of French composer Philippe Rombi for the 2005 film Joyeux Noël, directed by Christian Carillon. I played this song and these words in China recently and found that the audiences were shocked that the Great War carried such an extraordinary message. I want to play the song for you this evening and put the lyrics on the screen. The song and the video accompanying it will be on the two screens on the left and right, and I will try to keep pace with the choir of Salisbury Cathedral who sing the song of it. It will not surprise you that the song was chosen for the 90th commemoration of the Battle of Vimy Ridge. It has been played here before, and it catches the poignancy and I think the predicament of the question, how do we honor those who die in war without honoring war itself? It was also selected for the 1998 British Armed Forces tribute to the men who died in the Great War and played in the Imperial War Museum, where the same choir you're about to hear performed it. Here it is. Listening to this song makes it easier, I think, for us to understand both the power and the sadness inherent in commemorating the Great War. On the presidential committee in Paris, on which I sit, I go through hundreds of projects on the local level about how to commemorate the centenary of the war. And what I realize is that these are the images that ordinary people carry with them, that they brought from their grandparents and transmitted to their grandchildren, that the history of the Great War is primarily family history, and secondly, that these images are so strong, which is why I've shared them with you today, that what we historians write only makes a very slight difference in the way in which millions of people feel the significance of the Great War. We historians are swimming in an extraordinary current, which I call the memory boom. We don't create it. We can understand it and contribute to it. And it is in that spirit that I want to offer you these remarks this evening about how to commemorate the war. The first point that is abundantly clear, and we've used it entirely in our deliberations in Paris about the European dimension of this story, is the word celebrating simply won't do. It has too much a taste as of ashes. The word remembering is difficult too, now that the last of the 70 million men who fought in the war has died. Commemorating is right. Acknowledgement, active knowledge, recognition, recognition, rethinking a catastrophic moment in world history. That is our challenge in this centennial system. So the question immediately follows as to what, when, and where to commemorate. Let me try to deal with these questions in terms of what I would like to term the degeneration of war, because the war of 1914 was much worse than anyone who went into it in August of that year imagined it to be. The First World War was born only at the end of 1914, when the immediate clash of arms produced a stalemate and created an industrial siege a million times more terrible than that of the Iliad. I use the word degeneration to describe the effects of industrial warfare on the way in which war was fought. And the first facet of this degeneration was the obliteration of the distinction between military and civilian targets, not as an accidental matter, but as a strategy of war. Civilians were targeted in the First World War from the very first days of the conflict. The 19th century norm that noncombatants were out of the line of fire did not survive the German invasion of Belgium and northern France. We know from the researches of colleagues John Horn and Alan Kramer that atrocities, that is to say the use of civilian hostages and the attack on civilian housing, these atrocities were built into German war plans, which simply could not traverse the most densely packed population in Europe, in Belgium and northern France, and meet its strict timetable of 42 days advance, not 1 second more, without killing and maiming civilians and responding to perceived, though unreal, resistance by what they termed Schrecklichkeit, or the armed, or if you will, the iron fist. For decades, German observers and others presented these charges as pure propaganda, and now we know that they were true. One of the reasons why initial reports of the Holocaust in the Second World War were disbelieved was because German atrocities in 1914 were defined as propaganda. That was not the case. The atrocities did occur in both wars. Both on the Eastern Front and on the Western Front, 1914 gave birth to one of the iconic figures of the 20th century behind me, the refugee, the man or woman, elderly or in infancy, traversing Europe to get out of the way of the armies. This is a photograph that was taken by an Austrian physician on the Eastern Front in Volhynia, now in the Ukraine, and everyone I've shown it to is immediately convinced that this is an image of the Second World War, perhaps out of Roman Vishniak or some of those great collections. No, it's the First World War which brought the image of the refugee as the icon of the 20th century to our attention. This is in itself, of course, not at all new, but the magnitude of the refugee flow was unprecedented. The best way to understand the Great War is to talk about thresholds. That is to say, the level of industrialized violence passed a threshold beyond human experience. And once passed, the application of that violence to everyone within the societies at war was a real possibility. What matters was that many of these people who tried to get out of the way became the targets of both sides. And in the case of the Russian retreat of 1915, after their initial advance in Eastern Europe, these people became the target of their own armies. Retreating after a major defeat, the Tsar's soldiers killed between 250,000 and 300,000 Galician Jews. The victims termed this catastrophe the Dritter Chorban, or the third disaster, of the magnitude of the destruction twice of Solomon's Temple in Jerusalem. John Reed, later the chronicler of the Russian Revolution, brought this story home to readers on both sides of the Atlantic. A new continent was born in 1915, felicitously termed refugeedom, that place where refugees go. We don't have a home for them still to this day, but in 1915, millions, perhaps estimates run as high as 20% of the entire population of European Russia was on the move in 1915, and they stayed that way. That instability is at the core of the story of the Russian Revolution. What is refugeedom? Peter Gatrell of the University of Manchester says it's a place where there are no laws and survival depends on a whim or the generosity of more fortunate people. It is what the political philosopher Agamben talks about, bare life. Gatrell shows the profound earthquake, the literal destabilization of the Russian Empire through massive population displacement from the very first months of the conflict and continuing on until the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917. Now, remembering 1915 requires us to move the story one step further towards catastrophe. If refugees were men and women largely without protection, what protection was there for those living as despised minorities in multi-ethnic empires engaged in a fight for their lives? After 1914, every country tried subversion of their imperial enemies through appeals to disgruntled minorities. There were German arms deposited on the Irish coast in the United Kingdom. Of course, this was all just wrapped up by British intelligence, but nonetheless, the effort to stimulate a revolution in Ireland was certainly tried by the Germans. The Czechs in Austria-Hungary were cultivated by the British. The great Czech leader, Eduard Beneš, who later became foreign minister and president in the tragic years of Czechoslovakia, had an office in London for the creation of a Czech Republic and therefore the subversion of the Austro-Hungarian army. The Russians sent Lenin in a sealed train right across Germany from Switzerland to Scandinavia and then across to the Finland station to make trouble for the Russian Empire. He certainly succeeded in that. And finally, the story that we should make as part of our commemoration of the Great War, an essential element, is what happened in the Ottoman Empire to the Armenians. Now, this is an example of part of the tragedy of refugeedom, that is to say, of families with all of their paltry possessions. Here is a Jewish man on the left saying morning prayer in front of his family, moving to God knows where. And I think one of the most interesting things to realize is that this was a strange world to the German and Austrian soldiers who occupied it, a very poor world, a world that had certain what I would call colonial aspects to it. These were people of another race. And according to recent research, between 3 and 4 million German soldiers who later came back to this terrain during the period of the Second World War had their first exposure to Ostjuden, to the vast populations of very poor Jewish people in the First World War, preparing the ground for what happened later. Here is the arrival of Belgian refugees in North Wales on the 10th of October 1914. It wasn't just in Eastern Europe. One out of every eight Belgian left the country as soon as war was declared. That's 1 million people. They went north to the Netherlands, they went south to France, they went across the English Channel to England. They were stuck there in circumstances that initially were sympathetic. That is to say, the locals did everything they possibly could. But, you know, like most visitors, refugees stay wears thin after a while. And it became very, very difficult to sustain populations of this kind. Humanitarian goodwill lasted only for a short period of time. And then the burdens of war took over. Now, the second thing that happened in 1915 is an extraordinary development in the introduction of chemical weapons. It seems to me that one of the dates that we're going to need to look at in the commemorative season is the 22nd of April 1915. Now, this is on nobody's commemorative calendar, but it really ought to be, because it seems to me that those of us who think and wonder and puzzle over what to do over the question of the use of poison gas in Syria are rehearsing the argument that started in the First World War. What happened basically was that on the 22nd of April 1915, the German army released 168 tons of chlorine gas over a front of about 7 kilometers. This is only part of it. But this is a photograph of that very first moment when weapons of mass destruction were used in the world. The very first moment. It is a turning point. And there were several reasons why I think we can talk about it. Battle, Clausewitz taught us in the 19th century, is an attempt to impose your will on the enemy, who then is forced to capitulate. It is a matter of willpower. Not when gas weapons are used. Closing off the option of surrender means revolutionizing battle. How can you, as it were, give up when you're surrounded by a cloud of chlorine or phosgene gas? Battle then meant annihilation by asphyxiation and other wounds. It was a change in the terms of battle, and of course was an object of the two Hague commissions, the Congresses of 1899 and 1907, which could speak against it but could not legislate it away. Now, the third, the problem with this weapon is it depended on which way the wind was blowing. And the German army did not exploit the breakthrough that took place when Canadian soldiers and French and North African soldiers fled. Part of the reason was it was very difficult for German soldiers to cross the field, because they would literally go in the direction of where the gas was. The second reason was the dampness of the terrain in Flanders, which kept the gas on occasion too low, so that if you literally didn't trip, you would be all right. Not the case in later years when napalm was used. Napalm was not just an asphyxiant, it was also a weapon that created enormous sores on the skin of an individual who was exposed to it. Here is one soldier hit by a later improvement, mustard gas in 1918. But then one in every four shells fired on the Western Front was a gas shell. By all means, let us commemorate 22nd April 1915. As we can see in Syria today, the world has never been the same since. Now, 3 days later, the world changed again. And this brings us back to the Armenian genocide. Now, the word is one that was invented only later by the Polish lawyer Raphael Lemkin. But he invented the word genocide initially to describe what happened in Armenia. Now, the quarrel between ethnic Turks and Ottomans had been simmering for years, and periodic eruptions of anti-Armenian violence had raised more than a doubt in the minds of the triumvirate that ruled Turkey in 1915 as to the loyalty of the 2 million Armenians who had lived in the Ottoman Empire for centuries. Some Armenians fought with the Russian army in the Caucasus in 1914, where the Turkish army suffered a severe defeat. But the fear of what later would be termed a fifth column was really a fantasy, and became a genocidal fantasy in 1915. What total war did, and I'll just use that term, describe that term later, it's war that totalizes the resources of societies. Total war never happens, but it's like Zeno's paradox. You get closer and closer to it, the more industrialization draws the resources of the whole world into the battlefield. But what total war does is to make it possible, thinkable, imaginable, to take a chronic sore and to finish it, to finish the problem, not just to change and challenge the nature of the relationship between Turks and Armenians, but to finish the conflict. And it is this that Hitler took from the Armenian genocide, that it was possible to take a chronic ethnic problem and finish it. The First World War made genocide possible. In my view, without the First World War, without what happened not only in Armenia, but also on the battlefronts of the Western Front, Auschwitz would never have happened. No Verdun, no Auschwitz. Now, the date 25 April 1915 is a turning point here. On that date, two decisive events unfolded. The first was the Franco-British invasion of Gallipoli. And that will be marked, without the slightest doubt. But now the politicians who are going to show the nature of their amicable relationship are in trouble. In New South Wales, near Sydney, the state parliament has voted to recognize the Armenian genocide. This is the first time that that has happened. And as a result, the Turkish government has said that these Australian politicians are not welcome in Turkey. At the same moment, as it were, that they want to commemorate the centenary of the war. I don't know how they will work it out, but one of the strangest phenomenon of showing the presence of the Great War in our own times is the fact that the Turkish government is a Holocaust denier. They have successive governments for a century have refused to admit that genocide took place. Partly they don't want to be tainted with the brush of the Nazi experience, but partly it is simply blindness to the character of the elimination of the Armenian population of Anatolia, a population that had been there for a millennium. Now, there was a landing on the 25th of April, and everybody knows it, especially in Australia and New Zealand. After a failed naval campaign to force the Straits of the Dardanelles, the Allies, at Winston Churchill's instigation, decided on launching an amphibious operation to land on the Western Peninsula of Gallipoli, to take the heights above it, and then to proceed to Constantinople, several days' march to the north. This would knock Turkey out of the war, open up the Russian front, and perhaps change the strategic balance. Like many of the things that Winston Churchill did before Hitler made him a great man, it was a catastrophic failure. Churchill was a man who was tarred with mistake after mistake after mistake, and it was only his defiance in the Second World War, and grand and heroic defiance, that turned him into the hero that he is today, and rightly so. Well, nothing happened in the way that Churchill wanted it to. The landing was botched, leaving troops facing nearly vertical cliffs to scale. They never managed it, and the operation turned into another version of the stagnant war of position on the Western Front. Now, the man who blunted the invasion, Mustafa Kemal, became a national hero, a legend, Ataturk, the father of his people. Those who suffered the defeat at the cutting edge were Australians and New Zealands, who, by shedding their blood and performing with unquestioned courage, constructed a national myth, one worthy of two independent nations. Thus, the apogee of empire, drawing troops from the Antipodes to Turkey, was the beginning of the end of empire. And you all know the equivalent story of Vimy Ridge in Canada. Until very recently, this, as it were, moment, 25th of April, was shared by Turks and Australians as national holidays, moments of national affirmation. And I'm going to Turkey for that 100th anniversary. As an outsider between the two, perhaps I can say something that makes sense to both. But the one thing I will not do is to deny that genocide took place in Armenia, and they know it. I think this is a very important turning point in the negotiations between Turkey and the European Union as to whether they are suitable candidates for membership. This matters. It matters because denying the existence of genocide in Armenia would make it very difficult for Turkey to sign the European Convention on Human Rights. This is a political issue of today's significance, not yesterday's. Now, I believe that on many respects, what we need to do is to commemorate the genocide as part of war in order to commemorate the war, in order to understand the horror that it unleashed and the incapacity of political leaders to really control the forces that they let in motion. It's possible that some of the Turks thought that they were simply sending the Armenians away from a possible field of civil war, but I've wandered around the Middle East in the summer, sending between 1 and 2 million women and children into the desert strikes me as a recipe for genocide and nothing else.